Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Michael Jackson. They Don't Care About Us. Michael Jackson, born on this day in 1958. Hello, and welcome once again. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Jonathan Zimmerman, who is a professor of education and history at New York University. His latest book is Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. And on Sunday, I believe it was, June 3rd, he had an op-ed in the New York Times called When Teachers Talk Out of School. And Jonathan Zimmerman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The perspective you brought to this particular conversation as an educational historian was interesting. I mean, about what happens to teachers outside the realm of their 8-to-4, 8-to-5, 9-to-3 job, whatever that happens to be. And it's teachers have always had a danger zone when they behave certain ways, but it's changed through time.
Yes, absolutely. You know, in the early 20th century, there were community rules against teachers smoking, against teachers gambling, against teachers drinking, even after Prohibition ended, and a host of other so-called moral codes.
And what you describe here, though, is the moral code might have been, as you wrote, in 1927, when a teacher lost her license because she caught her smoking cigarettes after school hours. Now it has to do with what teachers who are very frustrated say about their students and post it on Twitter and the web and Facebook.
Right. And that's obviously why I wrote the piece. And I should say that I don't see rules and penalties for teachers who post nasty things about their students on the web as in any way analogous to rules against teachers smoking or drinking outside of school. And I'm somewhat offended by that parallel. I don't think there's one at all. It seems to me that we should interdict very strongly teachers that flame in this way on the internet against their students, because that's actually an abrogation of their professional duty in the ways that drinking or smoking after school hours is not.
One of the things, though, I thought about is reading this article. I mean, having been a teacher and lived with a teacher for 25 years and been around them all the time and covering it so much over the years, is that there are many when teachers are frustrated, like any other job, their humor is to laugh about the people around them. Humor may be to laugh about the students or the principal, just like nurses may laugh about a patient coming in or about what a hospital supervisor did, or a policeman may laugh about the latest suspect he busted or she busted. And that's usually done in a collegial atmosphere where people are just laughing, and some people participate and some don't. But that is almost a normal way of being for anybody in any profession. But what's happened is this new technology of communication has changed that. Just like what happened to Mr.
It has, and I think part of being a professional is actually limiting your speech. I mean, it's funny you mentioned nurses, because my wife is a physician. She actually trained at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And after a long day of seeing patients, she may come home to me and over dinner complain about some of them. But she will not post that on the internet.
Uh-huh.
So, look, I understand the frustrations and the challenges of being a teacher today. And I well understand the need to blow off steam in the way that you're describing. But I would say that by apologizing or even defending the, quote, right of teachers to flame in this way on the net, we're actually eroding and insulting their professionalism. A professional is somebody who exerts discretion at moments like this. And if we try to explain away or apologize for the teachers that say awful things about their students on the net,
mm-hmm.
what we're actually doing is degrading their professional status.
What I'm saying is you think that this has to do with normal behavior of people who are in any world, but what's happened, not for everybody, but for a body of people, but what's happened is that it's become so public because of the technology that we use.
Well, that certainly provides, let's just say, an opportunity to broadcast these sentiments in ways that people generally didn't before. But also let me emphasize that although I don't support the, quote, right of teachers to, as in one instance, call their students streetwalkers on the net, I'm deeply concerned about their rights within the classroom. And that's really the reason that I wrote my piece in the Times. Ironically, at the same moment that teachers are being suspended or in some cases fired for writing nasty things about their students on the net, thanks to different court decisions, their right to express themselves about political matters in the classroom has been radically inhibited. And it seems to me that's the real story here. That's what we should be talking about. The vast majority of teachers, let me emphasize, I too am a former junior high school and high school teacher. Please understand the vast majority of teachers do not behave in the ways that I'm describing here. The vast majority of teachers do show the kind of professional discretion that I'm describing.
Yes.
But some of them don't, and I think that we should censure and censor them very sharply. But we should also recognize that the real danger to teachers' freedom of speech doesn't lie in a school district that's suspending a teacher for writing bad things in the net. It lies in these new court decisions and rules that almost completely gut teachers' freedom of speech in their own classrooms.
To describe that in more detail for our listeners, if you
will.
Well,
let me just give you a couple of examples.
Please.
A few years ago in Indiana, there's a fifth-grade teacher who is using, it was either Newsweek or Time, has a kid's edition, you know, a student edition. He's using that to teach a current events lesson. There's something about the Iraq War and about protests against the war, that is, domestic protests against the war. And a kid in the class says, Ms., whatever her name was, have you ever been to an anti-war protest? And she says, yes, I have. And in fact, I was driving the other day in Bloomington, and I drove by one, and I honked my horn. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's all she said. She was fired. She was fired for saying that. A couple of years later, there's a teacher in Ohio, an English teacher, high school, who's doing an exercise that I did with my own high school students, which is, here's a list of the 100 most banned books, according to the American Library Association. Of course, you know what they are. You know, Harry Potter, Huck Finn, Catcher in the Rye. I want everybody to choose a book, read it, and report to the class about why it's been banned. Fired. Fired.
What school system was this?
This Ohio teacher was.
Ohio teacher, right.
Leading her students in that exercise. This is an enormous scandal. It's actually related to the question of professionalism, because the professional duty of the teacher starts and ends with training people to be citizens. And they cannot do that if we limit their in-classroom speech in this manner.
So let's talk about what may be going on here on a number of levels. I mean, when there's been a long history of in the last 20 or 30, 40 years especially, of teachers fighting to be respected as professionals, and you're seeing now like a constant assault on teachers, especially teachers who have been in the classroom a long time, in favor of younger people coming in from Teach for America, wherever that might be, and people battling over what it means to be a teacher, what professional means, and protection of jobs and all that goes
right
with that.
And the other context is states like Wisconsin, right, where the legislatures have eroded or eliminated teachers' collective bargaining rights. I mean, that's an important context here as well.
So what do you think of that? What do you think that what is that political dynamic going on? Well, what do you think it is saying both about the nature of teaching and the politics of education in this country?
Well, it all speaks to the low professional status of teachers. You're absolutely right about that. Look, speaking of Hopkins Hospital, as you know, there's a big nursing shortage in this country, okay? Let us imagine that somebody like yourself started an organization called Nurses for America. And what Nurses for America did is it took Yale undergrads right after they graduated, gave them a 5-week training course, and then put them in teaching hospitals to, you know, draw blood and administer injections. There would be a firestorm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention a liability crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would abide by that, ever, ever, ever. Let me emphasize that I have a huge respect for Teach for America. I have many former students doing Teach for America. I'm not criticizing Teach for America. But since you mentioned it, I do think Teach for America, as laudable as it is in and of itself an illustration of the low professional status of teachers. And I think the comparison to nurses underscores that.
But then there's also the two issues that you've raised here, and it seems that there is a battleground going on about what to teach and how to teach and what you're allowed to teach and what you're not allowed to teach. It makes me think about something else that you wrote a while back, a couple of years ago, I believe, on the whole battle that was taking place in Texas over textbooks. It was last year that you wrote this. And it struck me about the battle with the conservatives saying, we've got to take all this liberal stuff out of textbooks because it's not telling our story, the story of a Christian nation, the story of who we are, and how one person's imperialism is another person's expansionism, how one person's free enterprise system is another person's capitalism that can be beat up upon. And the idea that we are now in a real battle over what education means and what we're teaching and who's doing the teaching.
Right. And the question of teachers' professional status and especially their rights in the classroom lies at the heart of this. And the Texas story is a good illustration of that. If anyone's interested, you can Google my piece, and I also did an NPR segment about the subject, because my piece, although very critical of the conservatives who were trying to impose what I thought was in some cases, it's a purely erroneous view of American history. I also said that I thought the solution to this dispute was to give the kids multiple viewpoints. Have them read both Howard Zinn and the guy Larry Schweikert. Howard Zinn wrote A People's History of the United States, and Schweikert wrote, I think it's called A Patriotic History of the United States. Give the kids both of those books, all right,
mm-hmm.
and have them, with the guidance of an expert teacher, decide what they think. Well, the email I got on this was fascinating and spoke exactly to this point of the low status of teachers. Several people said they did not think teachers would be able to lead that discussion.
Wow.
Others said that they thought that teachers would skew the discussion, that we can't have that much deliberation in our schools because the teachers aren't skilled enough to lead the discussion in a way that let's just say that avoids indoctrination. So what does that tell you? It tells you quite simply that we do not trust our teachers. Now, I can also say, and this is as somebody whose primary appointment is in the School of Education, that we have not done a good job of preparing teachers. Let me be very clear about what I'm saying. There are lots of wonderfully prepared and able teachers in this country. But every major national report about teacher education, really now going back 40 years, has underscored its inadequacies. And yes, part of it has to do with the fact that in some subject areas, teachers do not receive adequate content knowledge. Look, Mark, I couldn't teach you chemistry.
Right.
And that's not because I'm not a smart guy, not a good guy, not an able guy, not a good teacher. The reason is I don't know enough chemistry. I could make you memorize the periodic table, but I think most reasonable people would acknowledge that that would not constitute teaching chemistry. The reason I can't teach it is I don't understand it as a discipline. I don't know its history. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what counts as a question. I don't know what counts as an answer. Unfortunately, because of the way we prepare teachers, the same goes for some, let me underscore some, of the teachers that we, quote, prepare in our schools of education.
So let's take a couple of twists and turns here. Let's take a couple of the couple things I want to pursue that you just said. Teacher education, and I want to touch a little bit on why we don't trust our teachers and come back to Schweikert and Zinn. But the idea of teachers as professionals and their knowledge base, I mean, we don't train teachers, at least from my interviews and my looking at these things over the last 18 years, we don't train teachers in history or chemistry, and then also in the art of how to teach those subjects. You train them in what we call, and not even the art of teaching, maybe in teaching fundamentals. But then you can go teach anything, people think.
And that's a theory, and it's a flawed theory. That if you give somebody this thing called methods or methodology, that they can apply it to anything. And
right.
Again, as per the chemistry example, this is specious. It doesn't matter how good my methods are, I couldn't teach you chemistry. Not well. Now, I could say thanks to several reforms and also several new state rules and regulations that the content knowledge requirements for teachers in many states have improved. But I would say, especially in the social studies, they haven't improved nearly enough.
So that's been the argument of a teacher education, training teachers, is one that's been – it's ongoing, and we seem to be in a real flux about it. I'm curious, as a historian and educator, a historian of education, was it different? Did the history teachers that I had, who I thought were fairly decent in the 50s and 60s, were they trained in history and teaching or just teaching, they happened to be teaching history?
I mean
– what's the difference?
They weren't any better, and by every way we've been able to measure it, they were probably worse. Look, there was never a golden age.
Uh-huh.
I hate to be a scold.
No, but, it's fine.
All the evidence suggests that schooling today is every bit as good and probably better as it has been in prior generations. What has changed, though, is that we school more people. I think a lot of people don't realize that it wasn't until the 30s that a majority of American kids aged 14 to 17 went to a high school, and that was because they couldn't get jobs because of the Depression. And it wasn't until the 50s, when my own parents were in school, actually graduating from school, that a majority of teens graduated from high school. So high school became a mass institution in ways that it wasn't in prior eras. So we do try to educate more people than we did in the past. But there's really no evidence suggesting, that back in my day, we walked 5 miles in the snow, no shoes, no feet. But kids today, the great irony of educational history is that Americans have been saying kids today since about 1640.
Right.
Really. Cotton and Increase Mather, these Puritans, they get there 20 years later, they're like, kids today. We came here to make this, this great, this errand in the wilderness, this city on a hill, and now look around us, right? Disillusion and dissolution, lack of discipline, lack of effort, lack of morals. But the one thing I will say is, even though there was no golden age, it's also clear that the stakes are higher now in the sense that we're putting a greater burden on our schools. And that's not because, we're good and they're bad, or they were bad and we're good. It's because the structure of the economy has changed. Look, when I was in graduate school in Baltimore in the 1980s, I lived in Canton in a row house that I rented.
Mm-hmm.
And my next-door neighbor was a guy who worked at Beth Steele. He owned his row house, and he had an eighth-grade education. Okay? That
right.
will never happen again in the United States. Ever.
That's depressing.
Except for, the occasional pop music star or pro athlete.
Uh-huh.
And even most of them have much more formal education than that. That will never, ever, ever happen again. Now, is that because, people back then were good and were bad? Of course not. The entire structure of the economy has changed so that formal schooling has become absolutely integral to life success, right? My neighbor didn't need formal schooling for his job, I should say. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there are other purposes of formal schooling, including, creating citizens.
Right.
But to work at Beth Steele, and most of all to make enough to be a homeowner, he did not need formal education. And now we do. So the stakes are just much higher.
So when did we begin not to trust teachers?
We never trusted them.
We never trusted them?
No, absolutely not. Look, teacher status in this country has always been para or semi-professional.
Always.
And always, always. Arguably, it was even lower in the 19th century when we created a common school system. And here's why. By 1850, the United States was educating more people than any nation state on the face of the earth, which is something as an American to be proud of, I think. But here's the rub. How do you suddenly, and we did it very suddenly between, 1830 and 1850, educate millions of kids? This is at the primary level, because remember, the secondary schools don't become mass institutions in the 20th century. I'm just talking about primary education here. How do you do that? The only way you're going to do that is by hiring teachers who have barely more formal education than the kids in their charge. And, okay, they're going to be overwhelmingly female because you can pay them less.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be, and this is what they were, largely unmarried females, because once you got married, you couldn't be a teacher. Unmarried females between the ages of, say, 15 and 21, with barely more formal schooling and barely more literacy and numeracy than the kids in their charge. That's what happens when you have this sort of hothouse growth. And I could tell you that so-called third world countries since the 1960s have faced exactly the same dilemma. You look at a country like Ghana, where I've taught recently, and you have Kwame Nkrumah saying, okay, we're going to have universal primary education. Woohoo! And by the way, this is a great thing, right? Who could be against that?
Right, right.
But who's going to do the teaching, right? In a society that didn't have that before, the answer is so-called student teachers, as they were called in Ghana. People, again, with barely more education than their charges. What does that do to the status of the profession? Nothing good. So here's the great historic irony, I think, which is, the thing that we're most proud of, or that I'm most proud of, which is our early commitment to universal primary education. In fact, if you'll excuse the modern, not so nice expression, came back to bite us in the rear. The consequence of it was a teaching profession that was not a profession.
I mean, it gets, what you're saying, what you're describing here. As you, the way you view the history of education in the United States of America, in the world, United States of America specifically, is counterintuitive to everything that's inside that's taking place in the public conversation.
What's counterintuitive about it?
Because what you hear in the public conversation is that schools were better, that teachers were better, that our schools were more contained and controlled. And that we lived in and now they've gotten worse. I mean, if you hear stories, but we did an interview not long ago in a small African-American town on the eastern shore of Maryland, and one of the things we talked about was this one-room schoolhouse that, remember, Rosenwald and NAACP built these schoolhouses around the country.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of them. And they talked about how when we went to the school, it was better for us than our kids because, A, the teachers were better trained and knew how to teach us, B, they cared about us because they were black and we were black, and there are no black teachers in this other public school system now, and our kids are getting lost in it. So and I can name you a dozen other stories where education was better 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years ago in the perspective minds of most people.
Well, look, there's a lot in there in your question, including the whole question of race. Let me say a few things. I mean, on the one-room schoolhouse, my last book was about this subject.
Right.
And it's called The Little Art Schoolhouse in History and Memory, and history and memory are different. We remember things collectively, and often our memories are colored, literally and figuratively, by events that have happened in between. Let me just say that we think that in 1913, half of the kids who went to a school in the United States went to a one-room schoolhouse. There were over 200,000 of them in existence. Now, what that means is there was incredible variation. So when I give talks about this book, often people will say, oh, you know, my one-room schoolhouse was great. And I'll say, look, it may have been. But here's what I found out. Most of them were not great, if great means helping people to learn to read and write and think. And there are good reasons why they weren't great. One of them is often you had a very, very poorly trained teacher or a teacher with no training at all in with a class of 60 or 80 kids ranging in age from 3 to 20. How do you do that? Well, what you do is you have each of them recite, really memorize, whatever book they've been able to bring to school, and they come up to your desk sequentially and they recite it. There were 12-year-old kids that could say a whole McGuffey's Reader, and McGuffey's Reader was, you know, the paradigmatic textbook of the 19th century. It's so interesting because whenever I read a news account of a madrasa in Pakistan where kids are memorizing the Quran, of course, course, I always think of McGuffey's Reader, because they were 12-year-olds that could say a whole 300-page book. I don't think most people today would call that education. It was very rote. It was very repetitive. Also, the idea that these institutions were highly disciplined, highly ordered, this too is deeply flawed. They were very disordered institutions, and that's why the teacher was always hitting people. I always say to students, you know, you don't have to take disciplinary measures if everyone is on the same page, right?
Yes.
The only reason for the system of corporal punishment, which was ubiquitous, and also punishments that we would call ritual degradation, you know, so which often echoed the infraction. So if you're a gum chewer, have to wear gum on his head, and somebody who spoke out of turn would have to get a twig they would affix to their tongue. And my favorite one is a poor speller would have to cut out letters from either the Sears Roebuck catalog or a newspaper that was available and eat them, which may be from whence we get the term eat your words. Nobody really knows.
It may be. I wonder then where you think we go at this point. I mean, if we're a place where teachers are not trusted, and you said that's been historically where we've been, and there are people now arguing, there was an article in the New York Times recently again about people arguing teachers need to be treated as professionals, paid as professionals, paid $50,000 to $100,000 a year and more, so we have the best of our students going to public schools. Has been the argument of the Randy Weingarten and other people looking at Singapore and Finland and other school systems. Where do you think we go?
Well, look, there is no question, okay, that one of the steps, not the only steps, but let's just say a necessary condition, not perhaps a sufficient one, is to get the strongest students into the profession. And incidentally, TFA is managing to do that. Now, they don't stay in the profession, which is a whole other issue, right? But more power to them, man. Like, 12% of kids at Yale going into the schools, if they were staying in the schools, I'd be standing up and cheering. And I'm standing up and cheering already. Mm-hmm. Look, you survey high school kids, and you ask them, what do you want to do when you grow up? The kids who check teachers have the lowest SAT scores and the lowest grade point average of the kids who check any so-called white-collar occupation. This is a disaster. It's a disaster with deep historical roots. But look, I think TFA actually shows that we can change it. Now, TFA is not a panacea, and TFA is deeply problematic in many ways. But one of the things I've written about, nobody has taken me up on this, of course, because I have this enduring fantasy that people actually listen to me. What if an innovative and a little bit bold institution, I don't know, say my own, New York University, said to TFA, look, instead of taking applicants your senior year, how about as a pilot project, as an example, or an experiment, I should say more precisely, you take them junior year, and we, in their senior year, will try to give them a full year of preparation. That way, during the ensuing summer, post-graduation, instead of having this facile training, which, by the way, even people in TFA acknowledge is insufficient, the students would actually student teach. Because, as you know now, we have school 12 months a year, right? I mean, we have summer school everywhere. So we would still attract these very privileged, I think, and highly able students, but we would give them more preparation that hopefully not just would give them more success in the classroom, but would make them part of the profession. The upside of Teach for America is it is bringing in extremely able and privileged people into teaching, but not into the profession.
Into teaching, but not into the profession. Exactly.
That's right.
It's a stepping. It's an experience like Peace Corps or VISTA that you go on to something else afterwards.
Precisely, and you're talking to somebody who was in the Peace Corps, right? Same thing. And stepping stone is interesting because, by the way, the male teachers in the 19th century used it as a stepping stone. Female teachers would generally do it until they got married and had a baby. Then, when the kids were a little bit older, sometimes they would come back. Male teachers often did a year or two, and there were 8 different presidents that taught in our schools. Nobody realizes this. Garfield was the only one that did it for a number of years.
Garfield taught school?
Andy Jackson did it for a year and said it was too hard, and he went off and read law. Harding taught in a school, and I've always loved this, that was ironically called the White House. That was just some weird factoid and coincidence of history. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson was the last one. He taught in this tiny school down near the Rio Grande.
That's right.
But in all these cases, of course, it was, to use your term, a stepping stone to something else.
Well, I am intrigued by your Schweiker and Zinn idea, teaching both side by side as the way to teach history, and all the rest you've said. I think this is a good kind of grist for the mill for our listeners to wrestle with stuff and maybe make sure we invite you back to have a serious educational discussion with some of our other people here on the air.
I hope so. I have a very warm place in my heart for Charm City. I lived there for 5 years, and it's still my favorite city.
Well, that's great. We love to hear that, even though you're living in New York City.
Actually, I work in New York City, but I live in Philadelphia because my wife, who's a physician, is at a hospital here.
Ah, okay. We all have these complicated moving around lives, don't we? This has been really interesting, and I look forward to reading more of your writing now that I've discovered you here with your article in New York Times, When Teachers Talk Out of School. We've been talking with Jonathan Zimmerman, who is professor of education and history at New York University, author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse and History Memory, his latest book. And we will link to his articles and his books on our website, steinershow.org. And Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. Take care.
Thanks. On our way out of here, we're hearing Friends by Michele Nedeocello, born on this day in 1968. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Friends. How many of us have them? Friends. Ones we can't depend on.